Today it's Tuesday, August 22nd. We're going to work on thyroid, adrenals, and pancreas today.
Okay, so on page 9, we're going to talk about the thyroid gland. Just wanted to repeat a couple of bits of info from last week's class. We know that there's two types of hormones made by your thyroid gland. We've got a set of thyroid hormones, and we also have a different, totally different hormone called calcitonin. So just thinking back to last week, where are the thyroid hormones made? Within the thyroid gland.
Follicle cells and the parafollicular.
Good, yeah, follicle cells and parafollicle cells. So the follicle cells are the ones that specifically make your thyroid hormones like T3 and T4. And we can store those thyroid hormones for about 30 days. Where do we store them? Colloid, yeah, in that jelly-like colloid, good. The parafollicle cells are actually different, totally different. They are the ones that make calcitonin for us. We know calcitonin helps to regulate blood calcium levels. So just want to keep straight that there's two different kinds of cells here, and they do make two totally different kinds of hormones. So when we're looking at thyroid hormones, we are classifying them into two separate categories. Thyroid hormones, the ones that regulate metabolism and, say, growth and development in a young child, break up into two, and they're based on the number of iodine atoms each one has. The first one there, thyroxine, is also known as T4, and that's due to the number of iodine atoms in a typical thyroxine molecule. So T3 then, of course, implies that there's three iodine atoms in triiodothyronine. So you'll want to be comfortable knowing that iodine is a major component for each of those thyroid hormones. So that's really all they differ by. T3 and T4 differ by a single iodine atom. Which one of these two hormones is the more potent of the two? T3, yeah, T3 is actually the more potent form. Which one is the more common form of the thyroid hormones? T4, yeah. So T4 is more common, but T3 is more potent. So this hormone is controlled by a hormonal feedback system. This is, of course, a hormone coming from the hypothalamus that turns on the release of hormones at your anterior pituitary. And that hormone there is TSH coming from your anterior pituitary and will target your thyroid gland. In response, your thyroid gland produces thyroxine. That's the most common one produced there. But we can also produce small amounts of T3 by our follicle cells as well. So this is a great example of hormonal stimulation, one gland producing a hormone that stimulates another gland to produce a hormone. So still, we are looking at a negative feedback system here for this setup, but nonetheless, it is a hormonal stimulation, a kind of a mechanism that we're looking at. I do want to mention something strange about thyroxine. Thyroxine, of course, is T4. Thyroxine is a protein-based hormone. How do most protein hormones kind of arouse their target cells?
Through secondary,
right. So what if I told you that the receptor for thyroxine is not on the plasma membrane, but rather inside the cell?
Gene.
Yeah, direct gene activation. So odd, right? You know, most protein hormones have to dock on the plasma membrane. They have to get their receptor to activate camp inside the cell, but not the case with thyroxine. Thyroxine actually comes into your cell. There, it finds an intracellular receptor, and it turns on direct gene activation. And the process of coming into the cell, it drops off that extra iodine atom, and it converts from T4 down to what? T3, yeah. So kind of an interesting case here of a one that does not fit the bill for your typical arousal mechanism for those target cells. Most cells in your body have an intracellular receptor for thyroxine, so that tells me that most cells in your body are going to be responsive to thyroxine, which is important because what is the main job?
to regulate metabolism.
Regulate metabolism, exactly. So you're going to want to have a receptor for most cells to communicate with thyroxine. Okay. So when we look at the major jobs here of thyroxine and triiodothyronine, we know that regulation of metabolism is pretty much the number one goal of these hormones. So how would you describe metabolism? Good. Stimulates breakdown products of carbs and lipids. If you break down a carb, what does that give you?
Monosaccharides.
Energy, yeah, monosaccharides. And of course, those monosaccharides generate glucose for that ATP mechanism. So we know that having glucose available is going to give you energy. What do you break down lipids into? Fatty acids, and their building blocks are glycerol also. And the glycerol can also give you sugar to give you ATP energy. So the greater increase we see for metabolism, the greater need we see there for those ATP molecules to come from those breakdown products. Let me mention the second function up here. Another job of thyroxine and triiodothyronine is to regulate development of our bodies. So during what part of a person's life are they developing?
Childhood,
right. So it is very important for us to have adequate level of thyroid hormones during childhood. Not so much a big deal for an adult because development has already occurred, but we really need to see T4 and T3 during those childhood years. Okay. So I'm being careful not to say the word growing because that makes you think of what?
Growth hormone,
yeah. So I'm trying to be really careful and avoid that word. So thyroxine and triiodothyronine are more for the development of your body as a kid, not so much as for the growth of your body. Okay, so I'm trying to be careful not to mix those two words up there. Let me tell you something about thyroxine. It is, of course, the most common of the two hormones made, T3 and T4. Thyroxine T4 is the most common of those two. And when it's placed into the bloodstream, it actually is picked up by a protein and transported throughout your bloodstream. Because another protein transports thyroxine, we call that other protein a transport protein, and its name is thyroglobulin. Okay? So there's a lot of places here for something to go wrong. If you've got thyroid issues and you don't have enough thyroid globulin, what's not happening?
The transport of
T4. And when you take T4 to your target cells and it goes across the plasma membrane, what happens to one of those iodine atoms?
It's released.
It's released, yeah. And that transforms T4 into
T3,
right. And T3 happens to be a more potent form of thyroid hormone than T4. So you can see there's a lot of places here for hiccups and burps to occur in this process of getting cells the message that we need to increase metabolism. So I kind of think of thyroglobulin as an escort or a taxi service for your T4. Because it's going to pick up T4 and it ferries it around your bloodstream, dropping it off at your target cells. Sheet there. There's a little bit of information about lab tests and lab results. I'd like to talk about that for just a moment. That is in the chart there on page 9. That should be up under the control column. So what are some things that may increase your need for a faster metabolic rate? What's that? How do you feel in the wintertime compared to in the summertime when you've got cold weather in the winter?
Slower.
Body temperature, yeah, you feel slower. So if your colder body temperature in the wintertime, you know, is slowing you down, then there's a negative feedback loop that will turn on to activate more thyroxine. So if your BMR, your basal metabolic rate, is slow and we need to increase it, what do we go back to in this chain of command to initiate the increase?
Hypothalamus,
right. So if you're cold, it's middle of winter, you're slow, increase your TRH from your hypothalamus, that's your thyroid releasing hormone. What does TRH target?
Pituitary,
good. And that, of course, increases TSH. TSH is then released, it travels through the bloodstream and now targets
thyroid,
yes, T3 and T4, good. So once we get your basal metabolic rate where we want it to be, then we negatively feedback shut off this mechanism because we've reached our homeostasis range that we're looking for. Okay, so on your worksheet, I just wanted to mention the numbers there because they're a little bit strange. If you happen to go to your doctor's office and complain of feeling sluggish and having weight gain or not really feeling energetic, is that something, right? Sign me up. But that is a typical symptom for thyroid issues. And so what they'll typically do is run a thyroid stimulating hormone panel. And so when they get this number back from the lab may say our normal range is 0.3 to 3.0. That may be the lab's range. Other labs may say 0.5 to 5.0. It just depends on what the laboratory doing the testing comes back and says is their normal range. So they're looking for the level of thyroid-stimulating hormone in your bloodstream. So here's how this is kind of wacky. If you're closer to the bottom end of that number, then your thyroid-stimulating hormone is only having to whisper to your thyroid gland and says, hey, make some thyroid hormone, and your thyroid gland says, right on it. Okay, so your thyroid gland is Johnny on the spot, it makes those thyroid hormones, and it's very responsive to that message that's being given. So, you know, I kind of think of this like moms and kids. You know, kids don't want to clean up their rooms, so when mom says once, hey, clean up your room, and you don't do it, mom comes back again, and mom gets madder and louder and angrier, right? So the more TSH has to yell at your thyroid gland, the higher this number gets. So if TSH is approaching 3.0, then the thyroid stimulating hormone is really having to fuss at your thyroid gland, telling it to do what?
Make more thyroid.
Make more thyroid hormone.
That's so hyper.
That is hypo, exactly.
I was just about to ask that.
Yeah.
So those who have hypothyroidism usually are higher.
Yes. Yeah, if you get your numbers back and you're closer to 3, you're approaching hypo territory. Exactly. Where are you going to feel better? 0.3, the low end?
The middle.
The middle?
Mm-hmm.
Don't feel good near the high end, right? Okay. So for those who do have thyroid conditions, they tend to feel better closer to the lower end of this range. The higher you get, the worse you feel. And I do want to mention that even though the numbers may come back and look normal, don't stop there, continue pressing. There are other thyroid panels that they can run. So if you come back inside this range and your doctor's office says, you're good, you don't have a thyroid problem, or you're regulated, you're okay. If you don't feel good, keep pushing. Yeah, because there is a free T3 and a T4 panel they can run. There's other things that they can do to assess what's actually going on. Do you think that TSH tells the entire story for the cooperation here? Because you've got TRH that plays a role, and then you've got this issue down here from the thyroid gland. So, yeah, I mean, just because TSH may come back inside this range doesn't necessarily mean that everything is working okay inside the body.
So, question.
Sure.
My particular one that I'm taking is levothyroxine. So, is it supposed to act as a replacement or an assistant to T4? Because that's named like thyroxine. So, we see that connection.
So, tell me that again. What is it coming back?
It's called levothyroxine, and they gave it to me because of my hypothyroidism. So, I was asking, is that only acting as an assistant for T4?
Oh, I gotcha. The medication that they're giving you, like Unithroid, it's acting as an assistant for your T4. Yeah. whatever they market that name under, Levo, Synthroid, Unithroid, all those, mm-hmm. It's going to act as a booster for that.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and of course, if you're getting a booster here, then it kind of plays along with the feedback mechanism to make everything look like it's okay in the body. Yeah.
Just curious.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. So now that we've kind of looked at what can go wrong with this mechanism, let's talk about some thyroid gland disorders. I'd like to first talk you through some hypothyroidism conditions, and then we'll talk through some hyperthyroidism issues. Just to make sure we're talking about the same thing, what is hypo?
It's below.
Below, good. And so, of course, we've got myxedema, we've got a congenital problem called cretinism, and we've also got goiter that can cause hypothyroidism condition-like issues. Okay, and then in just a moment, we'll come back and talk about hyperthyroidism issues, things, again, like goiter or Graves' disease. So the word myxedema has the word edema hidden in there. We probably know that edema means swelling, yeah. So people who have a very, very slow metabolism may in fact see swelling because their bodies are not running the metabolic rates fast enough. You definitely don't want to let your thyroid get to the point of being in the myxedema range. This is severe, untreated hypothyroidism. People in this range are going to feel very lethargic. They may experience weight gain. Our hair becomes brittle and may fall out when we experience a severe decrease in thyroxine levels in the body. Also, people can't think clearly. They feel like they're in a mental fog. You know how sometimes you wake up out of a dream and you can't get your bearings straight? That's kind of what it's like to be in myxedema. It's like you just can't really get your thoughts focused in together. So this is a severe case of hypothyroidism. Typically what we see here is an adult case of this. I'm just checking to see if anybody needs to copy before I switch slides. Y'all good? Okay. So the lady on the left has myxedema. You'll notice her eyes there kind of puffy and swollen. The man on the right also has myxedema. It looks like weight gain, doesn't it? Yeah, but after he was treated with something like Unithroid or Synthroid or Levothyroxine, you can see that his whole facial complex changed after that. Another form of hypothyroidism is a congenital issue called cretinism. And cretinism and congenital hypothyroidism are essentially present from birth. In fact, it's so important for babies to have the proper levels of thyroid hormones that they test the day they're born. They prick their foot, they take a little sample of blood, and they test for TSH levels. And of course, if they're low, then they can start treatment immediately. Why is it so important for a young child or an infant to have proper thyroxine levels? Okay, so it's that development, right? Okay, so development, metabolism is really critical from day one, so that's why they test babies that are born for thyroid-stimulating hormone levels. People who grow up without ample amounts of TSH may have these kinds of symptoms, an underdeveloped body. We may see muscles and bones that don't necessarily grow like they're supposed to. They're weakened. We also see thick skin because skin requires metabolism hormones to tell them to grow and replace those old, worn-out layers. And we also see the central nervous system affected. So we may see mental retardation form simply because of a lack of thyroxine. So that tells you how incredibly important this hormone is. Nowadays, you know, we hope to not see this anymore because we can treat this from birth. But back in the time period, like from where these textbooks came, maybe they didn't know to test for it and they perhaps didn't know how to treat this condition. You can see that the person who has cretinism is dwarfed, and you can see the characteristic growth pattern there. The body just doesn't have the ample thyroxine levels to develop properly. Like I said, I'm trying to really avoid using the word growing because that makes you immediately think of growth hormone, but yet it's development that's the real issue here. This is a picture from a textbook in the 1950s. This is a 16-year-old girl, believe it or not, and she had been diagnosed with cretinism. After 2 years of treatment, this is how her body changed. So big changes over 2 years period of time. One thing I want you to notice, at age 16, it looks like she was maybe 3 or 4 years old, body size, right? Had not passed through puberty. So what happened to her after she started taking thyroxine? She went to puberty. What does that tell you about the relationship between thyroxine and sex hormones?
It helps it develop.
Very important, yes. So thyroxine gives permission for sex hormones to do their job. So until she got ample levels of thyroxine, her body was just not going to go through puberty.
So did she actually grow taller?
She did grow taller, yeah. I wish they had told her heights there, but they did not. But big difference, yeah. And on the far left, another patient with cretinism, again, dwarfs the body in size. Kind of makes the body look like those with achondroplasia. The torso is elongated and the arms and legs are shortened, as you see with these two here. Let's talk about goiter for just a moment. The symptoms of goiter can actually mimic either hypo or hyperthyroidism. The problem with this condition is the body's not getting enough iodine, or the thyroid gland is not able to synthesize the thyroid hormones with that iodine. So why is iodine important for your thyroid gland? Good, makes the components of the hormone, exactly. So what your thyroid gland does is it takes the iodine out of the bloodstream and it uses that iodine to synthesize or make those thyroid hormones. When you don't have enough iodine in the bloodstream, your thyroid gland enlarges and it tries to concentrate the iodine present into those thyroid hormones. The less iodine you have, the bigger that gland can get. And consider where it's sitting. What is a potential problem for having your thyroid gland enlarge?
Breathing.
Breathing, yes. So it wraps around your trachea. It can put the squeeze on your trachea. So people with goiter may often complain of symptoms like what? What's that?
Difficulty swallowing.
Good.
Breathing
issues, right? You may feel like somebody's got a grab around their trachea. Okay.
Don't people with thyroid problems usually have like their eyes bulge?
That is a Graves' disease issue. Yeah, I actually got a picture of that, that exothalamus condition. Yeah. Kind of interesting history here in the U.S. The shaded region near the top portion of the U.S. has low levels of iodine in the soil and the lakes. So we normally hear that iodine comes from things like seafood. Iodine also comes in the foods that you grow in the soils. So if you plant a garden, you know, you're probably going to extract enough iodine out of the soil to get your thyroid hormone regulated properly. But not the case up here. Even the Great Lakes did not have enough iodine, so those that were extracting fish out of the Great Lakes were more at risk for having a goiter. So about 100 years ago, you know, they had enough people with goiter that they said, hey, there's something wrong with this region of the U.S. What can we do to help all these people with these goiters? Iodized salt, exactly. So if you're in the grocery store, feel all smart and check out the salt aisle. There is iodized salt and there's non-iodized salt, okay? And so you may just by habit pick up that iodized salt. That should give your thyroid gland enough iodine to be able to make thyroid hormones.
But do they make, instead of you don't eat salt, you don't eat salt, table salt, do they have something like iodine salt?
They have iodine supplements, but most likely you're getting it from, if you eat local foods grown in this area, most likely you're getting iodine from those as well. So yeah, if you completely cut extra salt out of your diet, you're probably still getting enough. Yeah. Just kind of thinking outside the box here, why might you want to purchase salt that is not iodized?
If you have
too much iodine, or if you have a thyroid condition that is
hyper,
yeah, so maybe you want to avoid iodized salt if that is your condition. All right, so goiter has a number of treatments. The easy one is to treat the person or the patient with iodine, give them some supplements. Another treatment could be thyroid hormone, like we were talking, levothyroxine, Synthroid. Those medications can help the thyroid gland make enough thyroid hormones. Kind of getting down to worst case scenario here, if the thyroid gland does not respond to iodine or to medication, then now we're looking at a surgical method for helping, you know, cure that thyroid gland. So removing the thyroid gland, giving a radioactive pill to kill the tissue, can render the thyroid gland completely functionless. And if either of those are your outcome, we're back to square one in providing medication like levothyroxine, Synthroid, to make sure that you've got enough metabolism to regulate your body's metabolic rate. So I just put that up there just, you know, in case you're interested in knowing what we would do for a patient who has a goiter. So these are some pretty bad looking goiters. You know, somebody may have simply a lump around their thyroid gland, but this is a case that's gone on longer and the thyroid gland is really trying to concentrate the iodine out of the bloodstream. All right, let's swing into the opposite direction. The opposite direction is going toward hyperthyroidism and a condition that we call Graves' disease. We're going to talk about a number of different disorders today, and if you have trouble remembering what Graves' disease is, the name tells you. It's going to put a person in the grave, okay? So Graves' disease is certainly a bad side of, or a bad problem with hyperthyroidism. Let's talk about some of the symptoms we see from having too much thyroxine. All right, so we've got stuff like fine, straight hair, intolerance to heat, and then there's, Taylor, you mentioned that bulging eyes condition. That comes from having excess thyroxine. Why do you think a patient would have a fast heart rate?
Because their metabolic rate is bigger or higher.
Yeah, you got it, metabolism's higher, everything's running faster. You may see things like muscle wasting because we're breaking down muscles to make what?
Energy.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't know, fortunately maybe, the side effect is to lose weight. But this is not the way you want to lose weight. I don't know, this sounds like a plan, right? Hey, hyperthyroidism makes you trim off the pounds, but it kills you in the process. So what happens to your heart is your heart rate goes so fast that you can wear your heart muscle tissue out. In the process of losing weight by losing muscle tissue and fatty tissue. So if you're looking to lose weight, this is not the way to do it. All right, so a lot of the things accompanying Graves' disease have to do with having a very fast metabolic rate due to excess thyroxine.
So is hyperthyroidism called Graves' disease?
Right, so you can call it hyperthyroidism or you can call it Graves.
I didn't know if it was like a condition that just came along with, or if it was the same thing.
They're the same thing, yeah. I mean, you can have hyperthyroidism and not be classified as Graves, but if the longer it goes on, the worse chance we have of developing this. Yeah. In some people, the tissue behind your eyes grows at a faster rate, and it pushes the eyes out of your eye sockets. The name of this condition is exophthalmos, and it's a real easy way to spot somebody who has a hyperthyroidism condition. The unfortunate thing is, once that tissue grows behind the eye sockets and pushes the eyes out, the eyes cannot be pushed back in the head. It's not like you can just make that tissue go away. So if the eyes are being pushed out of the eye socket by excess tissue, what are some of the risks we run for that eyeball? Yeah, vision issues, damage to the eye surface, cornea could dry out. Okay.
But they have a surgery now.
They do. Mm-hmm. Kind of like that.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I don't know. My grandma, she didn't have that. Just on the side of her, the crease of her eye.
Oh, did they?
Just like an incision. She said it hurt, but it worked. Her eye was.
Well, that's good. Maybe they extract.
But that was up north, though. So.
Yeah, maybe they don't have that.
They're not going to do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it a little harder? Or is that just
She actually had her eyes tacked shut. She's a local lady, and she had her eyes tacked shut because her corneas had dried out and gotten infected. So they were tacking her eyes shut to give her eye a chance to moisten up and heal.
They have gauze in her eye?
It looks like it, yeah. Or maybe that's a stitch. Yeah. Ouch. So Graves' disease has several functions here to increase your body's basal metabolic rate. You'll notice here that you've got everything from the rapid heart rate, weight loss, all the way down to muscle weakness. But this is not the way to lose weight. Having a fast heart rate can wear out your heart, and a person can die from having their heart tissue wear out. That's why Graves' disease can put you in the grave.
Yeah, indeed. They put you in the grave.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so completely switching gears. We are now done with thyroxine and its buddy T3. Let's switch gears and talk about the other hormone produced by your thyroid gland called calcitonin. All right, so what does this hormone regulate?
Blood levels of calcium.
Blood levels of calcium, good. Okay, what type of cell produces calcitonin?
Parafollicles,
good. Parafollicle cells produce that calcitonin hormone. What is the stimulus? High blood calcium will stimulate the thyroid gland's parafollicle cells. And of course, calcitonin in the bloodstream will tell your osteoblast to do what?
Take
it from the blood, store it in the bones. Right. During what time of your life do you think calcitonin is really active?
Childhood.
Yeah. So kids that are growing definitely have calcitonin pulling calcium from their bloodstream and depositing that calcium to their bones. They believe that as adults, calcitonin is less responsible for calcium regulation and that parathyroid hormone, the antagonist, is actually the more responsible hormone. Okay. So just kind of thinking about this one for a moment. If blood calcium levels stimulate the release of calcitonin, are we looking at hormonal, humoral, or neural stimulation?
Humoral,
good. And if calcitonin release is inhibited once blood calcium levels return to normal, does this sound like a positive or a negative feedback mechanism?
It's negative.
Right, so we shut off secretion once we get back into that normal range. Okay, so that should take care of page 9 for us. All right, any questions there? Talk about your parathyroid glands. They're over on the top of page 10. So you think about the thyroid gland as being shaped like a bow tie or a butterfly, and if you were to remove the thyroid and look at the back side of it, you would find around 4 to 8 nodules of tissue that form your parathyroid glands. The parathyroid glands produce one hormone, and hey, this is real easy. What's the name of the hormone?
Parathyroid
hormone, good. And we can shorten that down and call it
PTH,
good. So, boy, you deserve something easy after having gone through all the anterior pituitary stuff. PTH is made by your parathyroid gland, and that's it, okay? So, this particular hormone works as an antagonist to calcitonin. What is it going to do for your blood calcium levels?
It's going to raise it.
Raise blood calcium, good. So where do we get calcium from?
Bones,
good. What cells break down bone matrix?
Osteoclasts,
good. So if you happen to have low blood calcium levels, then we're going to raise blood calcium through the action of osteoclasts. They are turned on by parathyroid hormone. Okay, so thinking big picture here, I know you guys have been through Bio-210, where in the body is calcium needed?
Muscles.
Nerves. So the nervous system needs calcium to release vesicles of neurotransmitter. And where do muscles need calcium? For what specific action?
Contraction.
Yeah. So if you don't have enough calcium for muscle contraction, or if you don't have enough for nerve impulse transmission to occur, you have an immediately available storage supply here in our bones. So we find that in adults, PTH is the predominant hormone. It's going to your bones and releasing calcium to make sure that you've got enough for muscle and bone, or muscle and nerve rather, activity to work. Okay, so the thing to remember here is PTH is an antagonist to what?
Calcitonin,
good. So very bottom blank there on your page, the hormone that is an antagonist to PTH is calcitonin. Before we leave this hormone behind, I do want to mention that bones are not the only place you can get calcium from. We can also get calcium from our kidneys. Our kidneys filter blood and remove waste products, and those waste products may include calcium. So instead of letting the calcium leave in our urine, we can reclaim it back into the bloodstream. So PTH has a role at your kidneys, telling them to reclaim calcium. Likewise, the foods that you eat may be calcium rich, and we can tell your intestines, don't let go of the calcium, don't let it be sent out with the feces, actually retain that calcium and pull it back into the bloodstream.
Is too much calcium what causes kidney stones?
That can be one cause. Yeah, there's two different kinds of kidney stones, but that can be certainly a cause of one form. And parathyroid issues can also cause kidney stones, oddly enough. So I just want to tell you, just kind of as a side note here, this issue called hyperparathyroidism can come from having too much PTH hormone. And in this scan, you'll notice that the parathyroid glands on the neck are actually glowing. They show up as little dark spots in this image here. And the problem with having excess PTH is PTH goes to your bones, to your intestines, and your kidneys, and tells them to reclaim those kidney calcium molecules rather back into your bloodstream. So the old saying for this particular condition, hyperparathyroidism, is stones, bones, groans, and moans, because having too much calcium in your body can make you very achy, yet can give you kidney stones, and it can make your intestines hurt because of all that reclaim of calcium back into the blood. All right. Looks like we're ready to flip on over to page 13. How about questions so far?
One
where it was fixed.
So, adrenals are next. Oh, it is page 12. Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
So the adrenal glands are going to be what we spend the rest of our class period on today, and this is kind of prepping us for understanding two really important hormones. Just to kind of lay the foundation for the adrenal glands, we know they're on top of each kidney. We know that if we cut open each adrenal gland, there's two types of tissue here. There's an outer cortex and there's a deeper medulla. That outer cortex tissue is called the adrenal cortex. And thinking back to last week, what hormone comes from the anterior pituitary that regulates hormone production by the cortex? You got it, ACTH. So I'm going to make the point here about adrenal cortex is AC, and that's controlled by your adrenal corticotropic hormone. That comes from your anterior pituitary. ACTH doesn't have a great influence over your medulla because it's made up of nervous tissue. So the medulla is a different type of tissue. It actually produces epinephrine and norepinephrine, or adrenaline and noradrenaline. And that operates under a branch of your autonomic nervous system known as what?
Sympathetic,
right. So we're going to leave that alone for just a few minutes. We're going to focus instead on the adrenal cortex. The adrenal cortex does have three layers. They're called zones. The outermost zona is one that's going to produce a class of chemicals called mineral corticoids. So zona glomerulosa produces mineral corticoids. And let me help you break down the words here. When you see the word corticoid, our clue is to say, oh, you are produced by the cortex. Okay? Corticoids are hormones produced by the adrenal cortex. The other thing about these corticoids is they are steroid hormones. So when you see the word corticoid, it says to you, I am a hormone made by the adrenal cortex. And secondly, corticoid implies steroid hormones. Now the other part of the word, mineral corticoid, is the prefix mineral. And in our bodies, minerals are things like sodium and potassium. So we're looking at regulating sodium and potassium concentration in our bloodstream. All right, so the prefix mineral in our bodies implies sodium and potassium. These mineral corticoids regulate sodium and potassium concentration in our bloodstream. The next layer of your adrenal cortex is called zona fasciculata, and this particular region produces a class of hormones called glucocorticoids. All right, so we know the history here. Corticoid says, I am made by the adrenal cortex. What type of hormone is this?
Steroid.
It's steroid. Okay, and because glucose, the prefix, what does this class regulate?
Sugar.
Good. And then finally, we've got a little bit of sex hormones made in both males and females. These are called gonadocorticoids. What do they regulate? Gonads, yeah. So Estrogen and testosterone influence the testes or ovaries. So gonadocorticoids are in fact steroid hormones made by your adrenal cortex, and they influence the gonads. I found this graphic. I think it's really cool. It really drives home the point for the adrenal cortex. The adrenal cortex regulates sugar, which is the glucocorticoid's role, salt, which is the mineral corticoid's role, and sex, which is the role of the gonadocorticoids. We've got all three covered here by way of one word, or three S's, of course. One graphic covers all three. Let's take our mineral corticoids first, talk about those. Instead of calling them mineral corticoids, I'm going to now refer to one specific example called aldosterone. Another great clue here, O-N-E as a suffix implies steroid hormones. Okay, so O-N-E as a suffix implies a steroid hormone. Back to osmosis for just a moment. So what is the basis for water moving from one fluid compartment to another in your body?
Concentration gradient.
Concentration gradient, good. So why might water be attracted to one compartment over the other? Is it more salty or less salty?
More salty,
good. So that's one thing to kind of think about, is this relationship between salt and water. Something else you kind of want to think about is this issue of dehydration and blood pressure. How do you feel in terms of blood pressure when you're really dehydrated?
Tired.
Tired?
Oh, is it your blood pressure high, or if you're dehydrated,
your blood pressure...
Oh, it's lower.
It's lower, yeah. So if you've ever been really dehydrated, you may stand up, you may feel like you're going to pass out. You may feel like you're going to black out. So blood pressure and dehydration are going to be related to each other. In order to prevent dehydration, what can we tell your kidneys to keep more of?
More fluid.
More fluid, yeah. And if you want to hang on to that fluid, you shouldn't just keep the water. What should you also keep?
Salt.
Salt, yeah. So that kind of goes here for aldosterone. It targets your kidney. It tells your kidney to maintain salt and water by reclaiming sodium. Water follows passively, and it helps to increase blood pressure. So when you think about blood pressure regulation, aldosterone is one that should definitely pop to mind. The last line there takes us back to BioTu10 for just a moment. If you do reclaim sodium, we end up dumping potassium. There is a sodium-potassium pump that does this exchange. Do you recall how many sodiums are kept in exchange for how many potassiums?
Three to two.
So three sodiums get reclaimed, two potassiums get dumped. Okay? So which way does water go? With sodium or with the potassium?
Sodium.
Comes with the sodium, right. So if you're reclaiming three sodiums, water follows passively into the body. And in exchange for this, we dump out two potassiums. So it's all about maintaining the proper electrical charge and balance.
That's how we're going to be hydrated, you get cramps.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm just checking to see if you need this screen before we keep on plugging away. Okay. So it makes sense that if you're dehydrated, that you may have low blood pressure. That is one stimulus for aldosterone's release. Likewise, low blood volume goes hand in hand with blood pressure. That too will lead to an increase in aldosterone or stimulate it. What is the relationship between water and salt and blood volume? If you have low blood volume, you may have low salt, perhaps, and also low volume of water. So we're looking at these being linked and related to one another. And interesting, high potassium levels are actually going to stimulate aldosterone's release. Thinking back to Bio-210, the more potassium you have in a cell, what does that do for the charge of the resting potential for that cell?
Makes it negative.
Makes it negative, right. So, unfortunately, if you make a cell like your heart muscle extremely negative, what might your heart muscle do?
Arrhythmias,
right. So we need to get rid of extra potassium. We do that by activating aldosterone. So aldosterone will make you get rid of the extra potassium. In exchange for dumping it, what do we keep?
Sodium
and
water,
exactly. So you can't have it all. You can either keep the sodium and water, or you can keep the potassium. But you can't do both at the same time. So we've got this mechanism here that either keeps sodium and water or it keeps potassium, so we're not going to be doing both. So this is kind of a complicated hormone. This is certainly not the first or the last time we'll talk about it in this course. We will hit aldosterone again and again, and each time we talk about it, we'll add a little bit to the story. There are actually four mechanisms that we're going to discuss for regulating aldosterone's release. The most important one, though, is the first one, and that is called the renin-angiotensin mechanism. The other types of control here are pretty straightforward. You know, sodium levels can induce aldosterone's release. That's humoral stimulation. Likewise, potassium levels can induce aldosterone release. Is it high potassium or low potassium? It's high, yeah. And ACTH can also play a role here, but interestingly, it's not the primary controller. The primary controller of aldosterone's release is the first thing listed, and that's the renin-angiotensin mechanism. So tell me about a time that you've been dehydrated. What kind of activity might have been happening?
Tachycardia.
What's that? Okay, good. So you got breathing issues, you got heart rate issues.
Dry mouth, dry eyes.
Dry eyes, dry mouth. Okay. What's that?
Diaphoretic.
Diaphoretic. So we got all sorts of issues going on here that can cause loss of fluids or an imbalance in the fluids and the electrolytes. So how do you feel when you were dehydrated?
Fatigue.
Blackout. Wow, okay. So serious dehydration, right?
I was playing softball, yeah. It's like pass out on the field.
So sweated beyond the point that you could handle it. Okay, so if you're looking at, say, severe dehydration and you can't drink to replenish your fluids, then your body says, you know, you may not be drinking for me, but I'm going to hold on to water. So what hormones, there's two of them, that tell your kidneys to keep water?
ADH.
Good. And now aldosterone. Good. Let me make a difference here clear. ADH only tells your kidneys to reclaim water, right? What does aldosterone tell your kidneys to keep? Sodium and water, right. Why is it critical that sodium be part of what you keep?
Because the water follows the sodium.
Water follows the sodium, right. And if you're just getting water back into your bloodstream, you're going to create what's called a fluid electrolyte imbalance. And so your tissues can swell, your brain can swell. So your body says, I'll make sure that the fluid and electrolyte balance is in check by making you keep both sodium and water. That way we keep the fluid electrolyte balance better in check. All right, so let's talk through that renin-angiotensin mechanism. When you're dehydrated, whatever the underlying case may be, whatever your symptoms may be, your body already turns on a chemical from your kidneys called renin. So why are your kidneys a likely place to know that there's low blood pressure? What are your kidneys doing?
They're filtering.
They're filtering and they're making urine, right? Okay. So this is a place for you to either get rid of extra fluid or keep the fluids if you're deficient in those fluids. All right, so renin is turned on when you have low blood pressure. It is released by your kidneys. It travels to your liver. So it's kind of like a messenger. When renin gets to your liver, it tells your liver to turn on a chemical that makes your blood vessels tighten. That chemical is called angiotensin. We call those chemicals vasoconstrictors. So I know we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves here, but if you squeeze your blood vessels, what happens to your blood pressure? It goes up. Okay, this is not a solution, though. This is a temporary fix, and it's not going to solve your problem because the problem is you're probably dehydrated. Okay? So angiotensin squeezes vessels, but it also comes to your adrenal cortex and says, hey, adrenal cortex, we're having problems here. You should probably tell the kidneys to keep what? Sodium and water. Yeah, and so we send aldosterone as our hormonal messenger. And aldosterone tells your kidneys, keep sodium and water. Sodium and water bulks back up your blood flow, and that will increase your blood pressure. So aldosterone, let me make an issue here, is for low blood pressure issues. Do you need aldosterone if you have high blood pressure?
Yes.
What if your blood pressure is 180 over 140? Do you need more water and more sodium in your bloodstream?
No, not really.
You really don't. Yes. So in that case, we should stop this mechanism and turn it off. So that sounds like this is a negative feedback controlled mechanism. So this is the number one mechanism for controlling blood pressure, aldosterone release through renin-angiotensin mechanism. Can you tell me a stimulus for this mechanism?
Low blood pressure.
Exactly. Low blood pressure. Good. And when we turn on this mechanism and we release aldosterone, tell me two things your kidneys will keep.
Sodium
and water, and in exchange for keeping the sodium, your kidneys now release into your urine potassium. Yeah, get rid of the potassium. Anytime this mechanism controls you, tell me about your urine output.
It
decreases, right.
Does it also get darker?
It does get darker, right. So dark yellow, concentrated, very small volume.
Right, I used to work, they had in the bathroom, they're like, if your urine is this dark, you're dehydrated, go drink water.
Oh, interesting.
If it's lighter, then you're fine. So I was like looking at them, like, why does it get dark if you're dehydrated?
Yeah, just more concentrated.
Yeah.
It's like apple juice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Since ACTH is not a primary controller here, one of the times it is influential over aldosterone release is during times of stress. Yeah, I've mentioned to you last week, if you've ever heard of people being stressed out and having high blood pressure and weight gain, this is the mechanism for doing that. So if you're stressed out, you can hypersecrete CRH. Where is CRH made?
In the hypothalamus.
Hypothalamus, right. What does CRH target? Right, so the more ACTH you now have, the more aldosterone you will then make, and of course the more aldosterone you make, what happens to your blood pressure?
It goes up.
Tells your kidneys to reclaim what?
Water and sodium.
Water and sodium, and in exchange you dump out?
Potassium,
right. So when people are chronically stressed and have high blood pressure issues, then it is ACTH that's actually amplifying that issue by turning on, you know, more aldosterone production by the kidney or by the adrenal cortex. So, you know, stress does a number on us. This is just one of the ways that we see stress manifesting itself through the hypothalamus. All right, so how about questions? Anything I can help clarify on aldosterone? So if I pass you on the street tomorrow and I say, hey, what does aldosterone do? You got two words for me. What are they? You got one.
Regulate.
Good. And if you had to tell anybody in the mall, anybody in a store that you meet, what does aldosterone control? You would say
blood pressure.
Blood pressure, yeah. And you're right. It keeps sodium, it keeps water, it dumps potassium into your urine, right. But for the common person, blood pressure, right? That's what it does. I did want to mention at the very bottom of your page, there is an antagonist to aldosterone. Its name is atrial natriuretic peptide. And for short, we call it ANP. So atrial stands for the atria of the heart. Those are the top two chambers in the heart. Natriuretic means sodium and urine. And peptide just tells you that this is a peptide or a protein-based hormone. I wish all hormones were named with this kind of descriptiveness. This tells you pretty much everything you want to know. So this particular hormone is made by your heart. It is made when your blood pressure is really high. Because what can high blood pressure do to your heart muscle tissue?
Wear it out.
Wear it out, right. So it can stretch your heart muscle tissue. It makes it big, flabby, and weak. And your heart no longer can work effectively as a pump. So your heart says, hey, you're stretching the heck out of me. Get the blood pressure down. So the heart itself releases AMP. And so what do you urinate and get rid of?
Water and sodium.
Yeah, water and sodium. So like the name implies, natriuretic. Natriuretic means sodium in the urine. So you urinate away this extra sodium and water. Bottom line, this one lowers blood pressure. Okay, so our next one is over on the top of the next page. That should be 13. We are looking at glucocorticoids there. Just checking to see if anybody still needs this slide. Okay. So instead of calling this category the glucocorticoids, instead I'm going to call it cortisol or cortisone. And again, there's that O-N-E ending for cortisone, which says to you, I'm a steroid. If you keep hydrocortisone in your cabinets at home, what do you use it for? Itches, maybe some burns, okay? And if you've got like an itchy mosquito bite and you put hydrocortisone on there, it should reduce what?
Inflammation.
Inflammation, yeah. So in terms of cortisone or cortisol, one of the big jobs here is in fact to reduce inflammation. This is an anti-inflammatory hormone. It too is made by your adrenal cortex, and it has another big job. It helps to regulate sugar levels in your bloodstream over a long-term period of time.
This relates to your high stress, right?
Yes, high stress. So we all make cortisol or cortisone in small amounts all the time. You would feel pretty awful without cortisone. You would be very achy without your cortisone. But you're right, under those high stress periods that we can see a big increase in these cortisone levels. All right, that big fancy word there, gluconeogenesis, means that when you are breaking down fats and proteins, you can actually create sugars for use over the long-term period. So if you've ever had somebody in the hospital, you've had work, you've had school, maybe you've had things pulling you in 10 different directions and you wonder how you're going to make it. You don't take care of yourself, you don't eat properly, or you don't sleep properly. And it's, what's that? That's your life. So that is the time that cortisol says, I'll take care of you. I'll make sure that we break down your fats and your proteins and turn them into sugar. So there's something rather evil about this. If you're breaking down proteins and turning them into sugar, you're breaking down your lean muscle supply. And unfortunately, if you don't burn that sugar, what do you store it as?
Fat,
right. So again, if you're stressed out, people oftentimes associate being stressed with gaining weight. This is the hormone that does it. If you don't burn it, you will store it.
Is that what causes stress eating?
To some extent, and some of that is psychological. But yeah, I mean, it is a cycle that can get you into this loop here. Just checking to see if you still need this screen. This one is not primarily controlled by ACTH. It is controlled by blood sugar levels, stress levels to some extent. But if we do turn on the stress circuit, then here we go. We've got ACTH coming from the anterior pituitary, and we know that tells your adrenal glands to make cortisone or cortisol. So, unfortunately, this can have really disastrous effects if you have excess cortisone or cortisol in the body. Let me just mention gonadocorticoids because they're kind of interesting. Throughout your entire lifetime, we all produce small amounts of sex hormones, and they too are controlled to some extent by ACTH and CRH. But it's interesting to note that males and females both make very small amounts of sex hormones at their adrenal cortex. So that means that males make small amounts of estrogen, and females actually make small amounts of testosterone. So even if you're 5 years old, you make sex hormones in those locations. Or if you're 95 years old, you make small amounts of sex hormones in those two adrenal glands. Interesting that they don't fully understand why we need those sex hormones throughout our entire lifetime and why we actually make both sex hormones in very small amounts. It turns out that it's more testosterone than estrogen for both sexes, but nonetheless, kind of a strange puzzle that the scientific community is still trying to figure out. Let's see, bottom of that page has a little bit on adrenal gland disorders. Let me see what we can do with Addison's disease in our last minute or so here.
I had a dog with Addison's
disease. Or did you? Kind of a sad situation. Yeah.
He was old.
Didn't have it throughout his entire lifetime.
It just happened as he got older.
Oh, wow. Addison's disease is a hyposecretion problem, meaning you don't make enough of the hormones, and it's actually could be two. It could be your cortisone or cortisol hormones. It also could be aldosterone, so it doesn't necessarily have to be one class. It can be both classes. We see issues like weight loss and muscle fatigue. We see, you know, general malaise or fatigue, low blood pressure. And you can pretty much tie those top four or five symptoms directly to either aldosterone or cortisone. You get down here toward the bottom, and it gets kind of weird. Why does skin darkening occur?
Oh, the low blood pressure. If the oxygen is going away, or there's not enough blood that's near the skin.
That could be. Yeah, that could be part of it.
You don't have your normal, like losing of the layers of skin, because the normal cell is interrupted.
That very much could be the case, right, because you're having slower growth there, yeah. And there's also another issue. You turn on a hormone called melanocyte-stimulating hormone. What do melanocytes make?
Melanin.
Melanin, yeah. So you may, in fact, be making more melanin to darken the skin. So there's a whole bunch of things that could be going on there.
But it also, like, change your bone density?
Yeah, it can make your bone density change because cortisone is going to contribute to some extent to that. The salt cravings come specifically from aldosterone problems. Really interesting issues there. Pica is the name of salt cravings. Why don't we pick up and talk about this one a little bit more in class on Thursday? My game plan on Thursday is to cover pancreas and blood typing. So if you haven't yet covered blood typing in lab, you know, make sure that you read ahead on blood typing for Thursday.